From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We are joined, as always, with our super producer, Paul Mission Control Deccant. Most importantly, you are you. You are here. And that makes this the stuff they don't want you to know. It's long been acknowledged, folks, in both the U.S. and abroad, that the wealthy and the well-connected get away with more than the average person. Laws, in theory, apply to everyone. Yet, in practice, we see that members of society's upper echelons often escape the consequences of their crimes. This is a two-part series, and in this two-part series, we're diving deep into a story we mentioned in an earlier listener mail series. It's the story of tobacco heiress Doris Duke, who on October 7th, 1966, fatally struck her employee, Eduardo Torella, with a motor vehicle in what she initially claimed was an accident. And that's just scraping the surface of this lurid tale. Today, we are uncovering the real series of events, and good news, we're not diving in alone. We are joined by the world's preeminent expert on the Doris Duke case, the award-winning journalist, screenwriter, and author, Peter Lance, who earlier this year published new evidence that profoundly challenges the official narrative. Peter, thank you so much for joining us on air today.
Peter.
Great to be with you guys. I heard your first initiation of this story, and I was thrilled that you wanted to come back and do a back-to-back episode. So let's get into it.
Yeah, don't bury the lead there. This is going to be part one of a two-parter, with the first part largely dealing with some of the background and some of your original research into this case, and then part two digging into sort of bringing it up to the present and the new information that's been uncovered. So yeah, let's dive right in.
Would it be okay, just for the purposes of people who maybe didn't hear our listener mail segment or just are unaware of this, maybe set the scene with who Doris Duke is, who Eduardo Torella. Just let's set up who these characters are and maybe the time.
Okay. In 1966, Doris Duke was the richest woman in America, third richest in the world after Queen Elizabeth and Queen Juliana of the Netherlands. She was the fabulously wealthy heiress to American Tobacco Company, which produced Lucky Strike cigarettes, Alcoa Aluminum, and Duke Power, which is now called Duke Energy. She was, as a young little girl, really, I think at the age of 12, she inherited a massive fortune from her father, who on his deathbed said, "Trust no one, Doris." And as a result, she was notoriously paranoid. Over the years, she became notoriously jealous, with a violent temper, and she had four estates and a Park Avenue apartment. Duke Farms in New Jersey, 2,500 acres. Rough Point in Newport, Rhode Island, the scene of the crime in this case. Falcon Lair in Beverly Hills, Benedict Canyon, which is the old Rudolph Valentino estate. And Shangri-La in Honolulu, Diamond Head, which is a Islamic-themed estate. So she was incredibly powerful, incredibly wealthy. And for years, 7 years prior to this incident, in the fall of 1966, Eduardo Torella was her principal art curator and designer. He had residences in all of her estates. She never bought a work of art without consulting him. They traveled all over the world. He was her constant companion, happened to be gay. I did not know this when I first started look into the story, but he was a war hero. He won the Bronze Star in the Battle of the Bulge, and he was an incredible Renaissance man. He started as a song and dance man, ended up designing hats, designing clothing, went to Beverly Hills, Saks Fifth Avenue, and then eventually got into movie design and became very close to Sharon Tate, Kim Novak, Liz Taylor, Richard Burton. And he was on literally on the precipice of a new career at the age of 42, when minutes after he told Doris he was leaving her, she crushed him to death under the wheels of a 2-ton Dodge Polaris station wagon.
Now, Peter, I mean, the initial thing that one might think is he's leaving me. He was her lover, that there was some, you know, chemistry going on in that apartment, but it was very clear that he was gay. Was he closeted gay? Was there a presumption that he was her lover? Did she think of him that way? Or was this just literally like an abandonment issue kind of thing?
Good question. Well, he was very decidedly gay. He had a partner, Edmund Cara, who was a very prominent sculptor on the West Coast. In fact, Doris had been out to visit them. They had a place up by Big Sur as well as in L.A. She hired Edmund. She knew Edmund. She was not jealous of him, but she had a voracious sexual appetite for men and women. And she, after my Vanity Fair piece ran, I was contacted by a gentleman who was a big game hunter in the Himalayas, and incredible guy, 90 years old, sounded on the phone like he was 60. And he told me that he was her lover after this happened for like 7 months in Hawaii. And that in pillow talk one night, he asked her about this. And she basically said, and he said, "I'll never forget this. He got what was coming to him. Nobody two times me." That was a direct quote from him. So we don't know what was in her head, how much she may have coveted Eduardo, who was handsome, had movie star looks, you know. But anyway, to answer your question, we don't really know what her motive was except possession. I'll tell you briefly, her common law husband, Joe Castro, Joseph Armin Castro, was a brilliant jazz pianist and band leader. They were together for almost 10 years, common law. And 2 years before this happened, well, one night, and they had a tumultuous booze and barbiturates fueled relationship, like a roller coaster for many years. One night, she's playing a little something on the jazz piano in Falcon Lair, and he made a crack, and she got a butcher knife and slashed his arm 150 stitches for just a little comment about her piano playing. And she covered that one up. He never went to the hospital, never went to the police, and she got away with that. So that'll give you an idea of her sense of power and entitlement when it led up to this event.
So clearly, just with that understanding of maybe Doris's character a bit, that she could do something like that and not get in trouble with it, it kind of casts light on the way, at least I personally think about this incident, right, with Eduardo. How was it viewed when this all went down initially? What was the official story of what occurred?
Okay, how about if I tell the somewhat of a summary of the actual event itself, and then later in the next hour or so, we can get into the real details of what I ultimately uncovered. So there's the phony story that was presented by the police, and then there's what really happened, as I determined.
Okay.
So what happened was Doris and Eduardo were driving out of the estate. He had asked her to rent a station wagon, ostensibly to pick up some artwork and move it down to his mother's house in New Jersey. I didn't want to tell her right away that he was leaving her. In fact, he'd been warned, all of his friends, don't do it. Do it by phone, you know. He literally he had just done a movie with Taylor and Burton called The Sandpiper. He made the equivalent, I think, of $348,000 the year before in modern dollars. He had 20 more years of like career ahead of him. He was on fire. And the next film he did, Sharon Tate was in, called Don't Make Waves. They were very close, ironically. So anyway, she wanted to pick up this thing called the Reliquary of Saint Ursula, which is a very interesting thing. It's a statue of a bust of a woman who was a saint, a famous saint in the Middle Ages, with a relic. It's a kind of a Catholic thing, you know. They revere bones of saints. We do. I used to be a Catholic anyway, and so they were going to get this reliquary that she'd actually bought a year before it had been restored, and they were going out to pick it up at the antique store in town so that Eduardo could give it his imprimatur and nihil obstat, you know, like, this is worthy of getting, okay? And so literally minutes before, and I interviewed a servant at the place, said they got into a wicked fight, which is classic Newport for a big fight. So they get into this wagon. Eduardo is driving out of the estate. Her estate, Rough Point, had these massive iron gates. They were 12 feet tall, wrought iron. Each one was 7 feet wide. They were freely swinging, but they had a stop at the bottom that kept them so that they would not swing outward. They would swing inward. So he pulls the wagon. He's in the driver's seat. She's in the shotgun seat. And they pull it up to like 15 feet before the gate, plenty of room for him to get out. So he got out of the vehicle, and then they kept it wrapped with a chain during the day. He just didn't even get a chance to unravel the chain when she basically committed four intentional acts. She slid over behind the wheel. She then released the parking brake by hand, and this is a very important element. She then put it into gear. It was a on-the-wheel gear shift. She shifted from park to drive, and then she slammed down on the accelerator with such force that it caused tire width gouge marks in the gravel driveway behind her. And then he hears the noise, and he turns, and she just goes at him. Now, I might as well tell you what really happened, and then we can tell what they said happened. It's better this way, I think, to tell you the truth. So what happened was he went up on the hood of the car, which is something, it's a phenomena that people do when their car is approaching to save their lives. It's like a lizard brain instinct. If you can't go left or right. So he literally jumped up on the hood of the car. He's staring at her through the windshield, holding on. He broke his right hip, but he was otherwise alive and well. She then burst through the gates. Now, here's the key. There are two more intentional acts after this. She bursts through the gates, and then suddenly, for unknown reasons, she taps the brakes. The car decelerates and comes to a slight skid of a stop. He rolls off onto Bellevue Avenue, the Millionaire's Row, in front of her estate, 80-foot-wide street. And he's hurt. He's calling out. And she decides, you know, how many moments did she, you know, take? We don't know. But within short order, she decided to commit, and she just drove over him and dragged him across Bellevue Avenue. The car mounted a curb, knocked down 20 feet of post and rail fence, and smashed against a tree, literally so that it was parallel to Rough Point across the street. And he was dead under the rear axle. She was the only living witness. The police essentially wrapped it up in 96 hours with her as the only witness. And we can get into the details of the cover-up later on. And basically, they just declared it an unfortunate accident, despite the fact, as I later found, the chief accident investigator for the department, Sergeant Fred Newton, who later became chief, determined within moments after he began investigating after the crash that she committed intent to kill homicide. But because they were going to cut her a deal and what I call a murderous quid pro quo and let her off for these charges, he had to alter the official police report, which ultimately I got. It was like the great white whale of the Ark of the Covenant of my investigation. But anyway, that's essentially what happened. But they claimed falsely she crushed him against the gates. Okay, that was the claim. She claimed in a very short interview, the only interview she did was like four questions, five answers in her bedroom 3 days after the incident took place. She said, he got out. We had done this 100 times before. Also untrue. I'll tell you why. And I slid behind the wheel and suddenly I was on him as if like the car like took over like Christine in a Stephen King novel with a life of its own and just drove forward. And then I was on him like that. That was it on the basis of that. But in order for that to fly, he had to have been crushed against the gate. But as we'll see when we get into this later, when I got forensic evidence, autopsy reports, pictures of the gates, I found two amazing photographers and their progeny who helped to get me these photographs that have been missing for years. We'll see that essentially there was no blood on the gates. There was no damage to the gates. There are photographs of the gates with Sergeant Newton in the foreground, like moments after it happened, working the scene. There's no blood. There's no trail of blood. But the first officer on the scene, Edward Angel, who I'll talk about, found blood and skin in the middle of Bellevue Avenue, exactly where Eduardo would have been when she, you know, ran over him. So that essentially, I had a major accident investigator named Harm Jansen, who works for a principal company in El Segundo, California, that does this kind of work. And he just was so intrigued. He did probably $10,000 of free research. And he said to me, look, if it had been a single sequence events, he would have lived. I said, what's that? A single sequence events. He goes up on the hood. She blows through the gates, keeps on going. He bounces off. There was nothing to impale him on the other side of the street. He would have lived with a broken hip. A double sequence events is what happened. She tapped the brakes, then he rolled off, and then she dragged him to his death. All the injuries to his body is fatal injuries are upper body, and all the damage to the gate is lower gate, and none of it suggests anything like he was crushed against the gates.
This is something that really stood out to me reading your work, especially that moment you just described that doesn't match her official explanation. A foot slipping and hitting the wrong pedal, maybe that happens once, but the idea that there's the pause And then there's more. Acceleration, I think, is in no small part damning. And you made a fantastic point that I found pretty disturbing, which was about how not just contemporary reports and law enforcement, but even later biographers seem to consciously downplay or ignore this death. And there's this really disquieting thing you point out, which is that very shortly after the death, Doris Duke begins making massive amounts of donations to the city of Newport. And just to openly connect the dots for our audience here, I feel like I'm asking an obvious question, but Peter, what makes these donations so suspicious?
Well, first of all, she gave $10,000, and you can multiply that by eight to get the current dollar figure. Okay, so like effectively $80,000 to Newport Hospital. Why did she do that? Well, you're not going to believe this, but it's true. The county medical examiner, Philip C. McAllister, who was an Irish immigrant, a war veteran, a wonderful man who happened to be my family doctor. Okay, this is how small a town Newport is. I had no idea that he did this. He literally, the night of, it was his job to determine the cause of death. He allowed himself to go on her payroll. And so he stuck her in a room. He locked her away at Newport Hospital in a private room and near the ICU. So that state investigators who were duty bound to interview anyone behind the wheel in a vehicular homicide could not get to her. In fact, they didn't get to her until that interview in the bedroom I told you about a few days later, and they weren't even told when it was going to happen. They got there at the very end, and Louis Perotti, one of the surviving investigators, told me, he's 86, the fix was in by the time we got there. So, you know, that's that part of the story. And so then she had Newport, if you've been to Newport at all, Millionaire's Row, Bellevue Avenue, this incredible street, behind it on the waterside is the thing called the Cliff Walk. There's a beautiful pedestrian walkway. It's one of the top tourist attractions in New England. And for years, Doris had tried to block it off with chain link fences. She'd been in litigation with the city of Newport because she was so paranoid. She had vicious dogs in her estate that were constantly mauling people. Okay. And so within, I don't know how many days, I think 8 days after this event, she gave the equivalent of several hundred thousand dollars to restore the Cliff Walk. So I call it a murderous quid pro quo. She basically bought her way out of murder charges. The police chief, Joe Radice, who we can talk about later, retired to Florida, bought two condos and a new building, even though his last salary was $7,000 a year. The lieutenant who interviewed her in the bedroom was promoted to chief over the captain of detectives. Another guy at present was promoted to sergeant. Even Fred Newton was promoted to lieutenant, although I believe he was absolutely honest about his appraisal of what happened. And eventually he became chief. But everybody got sort of taken care of in the food chain in Newport, Rhode Island, and the upper echelons of law enforcement. And Doris just skated. And however, and this is, you know, you can prompt us with a question. The family of Eduardo, he was the youngest of nine children in this wonderfully middle-class Italian-American family in Dover, New Jersey. And he, his eight brothers and, you know, five sisters and three brothers asked Doris to settle with them for his wrongful death. You can imagine, and why not? So they asked for $600,000, multiply that time eight. She refused. They then went down to 200,000. She refused. This is at a time when she was making $1 million a week in interest on her money. She could stand in the corner of a room for a week, do nothing, and be $1 million richer. And she refused, forcing them to file a wrongful death case in Providence 5 years later, after which she had restored a number of more than 70 colonial-era houses that saved Newport from bankruptcy after the Navy had begun to pull out. Newport was on the verge of bankruptcy, and Doris comes in, moves these colonial houses around to the point where Amistad was shot in Newport. That's how beautiful this town is in the colonial era that she was responsible for. And by the time the wrongful death trial happens, she's found civilly liable for his death. And guess what? When they get to the damage phase, how much she owes his family? $75,000 was the total. And after the lawyers took their cut, each brother and sister got $5,620. For the death of this remarkable man.
Well, he was a remarkable man. I mean, you're talking about how he was going, kind of spreading his own wings, kind of going his own way. He was going to become a big consultant in Hollywood in the motion picture industry. He was making a lot of money on his own outside of Doris and that relationship. And I think you mentioned in the Vanity Fair piece, in any way, that calculation from his family was based on how much money he would have continued to generate during his life. So it wasn't even like a cash grab or some kind of like greedy thing at all.
Yeah, exactly. Although here's a very interesting thing. I'm jumping ahead, guys, but Doris, you used the term hagiography in your last broadcast, which is a term I found that it was very appropriate, which is the reverence of certain figures as if they're religious figures, hagiography, right? You clean up after somebody after whatever evil they've wrought in their lives, and suddenly they're up on Mount Olympus. Well, Doris, during her lifetime, she was such a controversial and troubled figure. She hired minions. She had private investigators, lawyers, press flacks that would go in and clean up after her. Example, the photograph that was in the Daily News the next day, which shows the underside of the vehicle, was missing from the archives of the Newport Daily News when I went to find it. That one negative was missing for reasons we can discuss later. The entire transcript of the wrongful death trial, missing from Rhode Island judicial archives. The only way I was able to piece together the trial was from press clippings and from the appellate record, which I was able to get. But the actual transcript with the photographs of the tire gouge marks and all that other stuff, gone. So she would regularly have these people go and just remove things and literally, you know, get away with murder. In the case of Joe Castro, get away with an attempt to kill murder.
We're going to pause for a word from our sponsor, and we'll return with more on Doris Duke from Peter Lance. And we've returned. One thing that I think we need to emphasize, Peter, this story, something really disturbs me about it is this story may not have come to light ever without your work. And I believe it will be helpful for us to explore a bit of your personal genesis of exploration here. So folks may not know, but you you and I were talking off air, you actually began your reporting career less than a year after this incident occurred. And you're in the region, you are connected with this. The question that I think is on a lot of people's minds is, what inspired you or what drove you 5 decades later to dive into this story? And how did you start putting these pieces together? I mean, just learning about your process almost makes me visualize one of those old school like crime boards with the red string connecting one thing to another. Like, how did this come about? I'd be really curious to learn.
It's a great question. And the reason I wrote the book in the first person is I wanted to explain that question. I mean, what kind of person after 50 years goes back to try and examine a case like this, financing the investigation essentially on my credit cards? I mean, I didn't get an advance for a book. I didn't, you know, no one was like helping me out when I did this initial investigation. But I was a young cub reporter. I always wanted to be a newsman. I talk about this in the book from the moment I was throwing copies of papers on porches at the age of 10. And then in 1967, I was an undergraduate at Northeastern University in Boston. They have this program called Co-op. And for 6 months, the first summer from June to December, I learned the craft of journalism. You know, how do you write a 5-point lead? How do you like read upside down when the cops don't want to show you the accident report? You know, how do you interview people? How do you get people to tell you things, etc.? Now, because I was a local boy, a townie, I'd grown up there, that helped a lot. My mother was the deputy clerk of the Superior Court, a total Rosie the Riveter of the law, never even went to college, let alone had a law degree. But she was so good at it that they kept her throughout the 60s and 70s. Everybody knew her. And so I was, you know, I had a good support system in Newport. So the first year, and I got a chance to cover the America's Cup races, the jazz and folk festivals. I mean, Newport, for a town of, it was then 46,000 people when the ships were in before the Navy left. Now it's like more like 26,000. But back in those days, it was an incredibly small space that had all kinds of international events happening all the time. So I cut my teeth on some amazing news stories and national and international news stories while I was learning the job. But 8 months, when I got there in June, the whole town is buzzing. Oh, Doris Duke, she got away with murder. And I was a freshman in college at the time. I was focusing on that. I didn't really know much about it. And so that stuck in my craw. The second summer, I actually did a four-part expose on slum housing in Newport, substandard housing, because I grew up like within 100 yards of this ancient African-American community, one of the oldest in America. Many descendants of enslaved people still live there. And this neighborhood had been thriving until the 1850s and eventually with Jim Crow, et cetera, had deteriorated into essentially a ghetto. And the black kids from my grammar school, which is right across the street, when I was in the sixth grade, some conservative naval officer got on the committee and gerrymandered the school district. So all the black kids had to go to an inferior school six blocks south. And, you know, the white kids from way far away, the doctors and lawyers and the sons of daughters of the slum lords could go to this good school, right? So that kind of stuck with me. So the second summer I was there, I decided to do an expose on slum housing, and it got printed in the Daily News, four-part series, and they won this award called the Savellan Brown Award, given by the New England AP managing editors. No paper under 100,000 had ever won it. The Boston Globe came in third, and the Daily News sold 15,000 copies a day. And I just found out, the year after we won that award, they changed the rules that said only 100,000 circulation papers could participate. But it really shook up the town. It created, and it had a wild effect, believe it or not, on Doris Duke's restoration work, which I talk about in the book. But they set up a community housing corporation to build houses like Habitat for Humanity for the people that live there. They set up an escrow fund the first night of the series ran. And it really had an impact. So that really defined my career as an investigative reporter. I thought if I could achieve something like that in a local town at that age, what else could I do? And that really is why I decided to become an investigative reporter for the rest of my career.
Now, Peter, we look up to you a lot. It's pretty obvious. We all make true crime shows. We've all kind of individually worked on true crime podcasts and IP. And just the fact that, you know, you've learned so much, you've been on these kinds of investigations. One of the hardest things that I personally have found, and maybe Ben and Noel, you guys have found this too, is trying to get information out of officers of the law. And it's often because they, you know, for one reason or another, they can't or won't speak to a certain, you know, investigation. How did you get information? How have you kind of navigated getting information from police officers and from police departments?
Well, I began with a blank slate, essentially. I decided in the summer of 2018, I had just finished adapting my last two HarperCollins books into a 10-hour scripted dramatic series. My mid-career was in Hollywood. We can talk about that later. And I happened to see a rerun of the Trump statement on CNN. You know, I could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and not lose any votes. Bing, a light bulb went off, and I went, Doris Duke. You know, and I'd always kind of wanted to get into it, and I never had the skill or the time to do it. My life got in the way, you know? So I just decided to start, and there was a Facebook group, a dedicated, still is, Facebook group called If You Grew Up in Newport, Rhode Island, Share Some Memories. Then had 10,500 members. And every 3 or 4 months, a guy named Larry Betancourt, a member of the group who now has his own group, would like post crash photos of the Eduardo Torella crime scene, death scene. And so I started mining that group. I kind of came out and saying, hey, I'm Peter Lance. I'm a Newporter. I'm trying to find out. And because it was a legend, still to this day, it's a legend. Every time people have friends from out of town and they take them around the Ocean Drive past Bellevue Avenue, they wax eloquent about this incident that Doris Duke got away with murder. Everybody believes it in the town, but no one had ever really tried to prove it one way or the other. And I want to start by saying I never, ever set out with a goal as an investigator. I don't say, okay, I want to prove that Doris did this. That's fatal to any investigation, as you guys know. Once you do that, you start excluding evidence that might be exculpatory. So I just let the Ouija board of investigation take me where it will. And in this case, four really important police officers who had worked the case and who knew fragments of the story but didn't know the whole story opened up to me One officer was called Detective Al Conti. He did not work the case, but he was a celebrated detective who got millions of dollars in jewelry, the stolen on Bellevue Avenue, recovered over the years. He helped me try to get the police report that had been, quote, missing for years. And I knew that the police department had it, but they denied it. He helped me with that. And most importantly, he put me together with Edward Angel. And Eddie Angel was the first officer on the scene that night, who's the one that found the skin and the blood in the middle of Bellevue. And he's the one that told me Fred Newton's theory of the crash. And that was a crucial piece. Another officer, William Watterson, Bill Watterson, interviewed Doris briefly at Newport Hospital, where they took her before she got locked away. He then went back to the scene and he found Eduardo's passport under the vehicle. He described the injuries that Doris at that point had when he saw in the hospital as steering wheel injuries, like as if, you know, prior to seatbelts and restraints, you know, what would happen if you hit your head on the steering wheel? You know, a cut lip, a bruised nose. Another officer, Norman Mather, who's retired in Florida. These men are all retired. He told me that he was there that night, and when the chief arrived, Chief Radice, he literally said, okay, Mather, you go write it up. You know, go back and write it up. So he goes back to the police station, but the last vision he had was the chief arm in arm with Doris walking into Rough Point. Now, is that when the deal was cut? We don't know. We weren't there. But what happened when he got to the headquarters, he was typing up the report in triplicate, as was the case back then, you know, carbon paper in between the pages. And all of a sudden, another sergeant ripped it out of the machine, crumpled it up and threw it in the waste basket, saying, the chief has this now. And the next day, this guy, who was then a probationary officer who could have been fired at any time, went in and knocked on the chief's door and said, chief, what's going on? He said, Mather, this is my case. Now get the hell out of here. And basically, don't let the door hit you on your way out, kind of thing. And that was, you know, that was his contribution to the story. So many of these people were important. And we're going to get by the end of this first hour to this new living witness that came forward. But when this witness came forward, he basically dovetailed everything that I had documented that Fred Newton had said about the six intentional acts that led to Eduardo's death. And that was what caused the Newport Police Department to reopen the case last summer.
So quick question, just for anyone unfamiliar with law enforcement, is it somewhat unusual for a police chief to take a specific case and make it, quote unquote, their case?
It's very unusual. It's unusual to take the person of interest, which is a new term, but, you know, the suspect. I mean, she wasn't even a suspect. It was undisputed that she was behind the wheel when she killed this man. And Rhode Island law says that the what was then called the Registry of Motor Vehicles had to investigate, had to do an interview with all people in vehicular homicides. But those two individuals, Mr. Perotti and Mr. Mazzarone, who's now dead, were not able to even get near her to do that. Okay. So, and then this is, I have to tell you this part of this proves the cover up by the cops. I just have to throw this in now. So what happened was there's a Newport lawyer named Bill O'Connell. I went to school with his brother, James, Jimmy O'Connell, who's a famous doctor in Boston, went to Harvard Med, and he ministers to the poor and the homeless of Boston. He's very famous, Dr. James O'Connell. And Bill O'Connell, I asked him about this, and he said, you know, Peter, I had heard from Joe Houlihan, and Joe Houlihan, so this is double hearsay now. Joe Houlihan was a remarkable Newport lawyer. He represented me at one point. He's a wonderful guy. And he worked for a while with Doris Duke's lawyer, Aram Arabian, who was kind of the Roy Cohen of New England at the time. He was brilliant but ruthless, okay? And Joe, who had been doing civil work, wanted to learn criminal, so he would sit as second seat at trials just to observe Adam's technique. And he told Bill, who told me, that after this first, Radice, basically the chief, this interview happened on a Sunday. The incident happened Friday at 5 o'clock in the afternoon on the 7th of October. So now we're at the 9th at around in the afternoon. They interview her and then a 4-question interview and the case is closed the next morning at 10 a.m. Chief Radice announces to the AP, UPI and the New York Daily News, which had a veteran reporter in town, okay, the case is done, accident. And then the Attorney General of Rhode Island at the time said, aha, don't rush to judgment. This is happening too fast. So Radice literally walked it back. He called the press back an hour later and said, oh, no, the case is still open. It's still open. And so what happened then, according to O'Connell through Houlihan, which I prove ultimately in my investigation, is that the chief went to Aram Arabian. The chief of police goes to the lawyer for the suspect and says, Aram, you got to help me come up with something to close out this case because the AG's all over me. And Aram says, I'll tell you what, you write up a transcript of an interview with her. And the chief goes, you mean you want to interview her more extensively? No. You're not going to interview her. Just do a transcript like you did interview her. And in fact, they typed up a phony 3-page transcript of an interview, Q&A, 3 pages that never took place, even though it says at the top, this interrogation by Captain Paul Sullivan at Rough Point, such and such a time, the next day, the 11th of October. And how do we know it's a fake? Because the first question they ask, they get Doris's birth date wrong. They say she's born in 1928. Her answer, when in fact it was 1912. She crosses out the 28 and initials DD. Now, if a stenographer had been doing this in real time, she or he would have caught the mistake in real time and would have been reflected in the transcript. These are the lengths they went to. And then when Mr. Parati from the state asked the chief to get the transcript, he said, oh, you don't need that. You got the transcript of the other one, the little 4-question one. That's good enough. You don't need this. Why did the chief hide it from the state? Because he knew anybody with a brain could have seen that mistake and realized it was a fraud. But the cover up was already in motion at that point. Doris was ready to write her check to the Cliff Walk Restoration and Newport Hospital, and by then it was done. And Bill Watterson said to me, I said to him, did any of you guys object? He said, listen, Peter, the chief was the kind of guy, he had absolute power. He could rip the badge off your chest. And all of us had families. We had careers. None of us could buck the chief at the time.
And with that, we're going to take a quick moment to hear a word from our sponsor, but we'll be right back with more Peter Lentz. And we're back.
Just had a quick clarification to Matt's question. I definitely have seen this as an issue when doing true crime stories. I'm sure Ben has too. When talking to police officers or officials who are involved in, like, say, an active investigation, if you find the right one, however, if they've retired and they maybe something didn't sit right with them, they're a little more maybe willing to talk. Is that what you found?
Yes. In fact, I'm sorry, I didn't get to that from your question, Matt, but when we get to the reinvestigation, which was then closed again, you'll see how the current police department ended up reaffirming this unfortunate accident thing in the face of massive evidence from me. My book has 60 pages of annotations, 438 pages, 915 endnotes, and this new witness that came forward who dovetailed in the midst of all of that. They concluded there was, quote, no evidence to change the original verdict. No evidence, not conflicting evidence or no evidence, literally. And I am convinced that the police department in Newport, circling the squad cars, as many police departments do, just do not want to admit fault. They don't, and this is true of the books I've done on the FBI. I've done 4 major books on the FBI and the road to 9/11, where negligence begets gross negligence, and then that goes to cover up because they're embarrassed and they don't want the outside world to realize that they may have screwed up. And that's just kind of a human instinct, maybe, but that's the way it is. That's why you guys always get, it's under investigation, And so you get these honest, that's why I want to shout out to these wonderful retired men who fully cooperated with me and told me the pieces of the truth that they knew so that I could put it together. I call it a mosaic. William Casey, I adapted Bob Woodward's book, Veil, The Secret Wars of the CIA for HBO a few years ago. Never got made. But William Casey, then the CIA director, talked about fragments of a mosaic. Human intelligence, spies on the ground, SIGINT, signals intelligence, ELINT, electronic intelligence, spy satellites. And you take all these little pieces of broken glass and you put them together and you step back and you get a snapshot of the truth, as best you can get it, you know? And that's what investigative reporting is. That's what intelligence work is about.
Man, Ben, doesn't this just... Yes, Ben, yes.
I think you're speaking our language here, Peter. This is something that we've also... First, we found exactly what you're describing. We've also seen... you know, it's... I don't want to say it's beautiful, but it's so true that often in the case of genuine conspiracies, rather than conspiracy theories, we see exactly what you're describing. Maybe an original cover-up, maybe just negligence or even incompetence, and then the multi-generational, multi-decade cover-up is the cover-up of the original cover-up or mistake, because people don't want to be fallible. This is, you know, I know what we're doing a lot in this episode today is we're alluding to a lot of things that we're going to explore, and that's because we already have to set up and present that there was a genuine conspiracy. People were, by hook or by crook, cowed into silence for a long time. One of the questions that I had to your point about circling the wagons or circling the police cars there is how much, if any, influence does Doris Duke's estate have on the city of Newport after her demise? And I ask that because sometimes in some cases like this, when very well-to-do people are able to pay off someone for a secret or to keep a secret, then once they have passed away beyond the reach of human justice, then things start to come out. But this just didn't. It stayed like, as you were saying, it stayed something like a bit of local lore for a very long time. So was there some power or influence from the Duke estate that continued to power this cover-up? Or what happened? Was it supposed to just fade into history?
Well, it's a great question. It's the question I'm going to seek to answer in my next book. My next book will largely cover the new witness that came forward, the reinvestigation that was opened in July, the tortuous 5-month investigation wherein Jackie Weiss, the detective, who's the cold case detective, by 10 weeks after the fact had not even read my book, which was what prompted the witness to come forward after he'd read the book. And it's not an ego thing, but it's just she began to turn. And it's on my website, peterlance.com. I have a timeline that I created of this latest investigation and where it went wrong. Just factual, not opinion, just straight facts. And basically, they ended up concluding that not only did they conclude there was no evidence, which is like one city council member called it an embarrassment that they would reach that conclusion, but they also decided that they'd embrace this original accident theory, which was corrupt, as I prove in my book. So the answer is that I think inherently, many police departments that have cold case detectives don't really want to solve the cases because they're embarrassing that for the reasons we just talked about, right? Or they just can't admit fault. As to Doris Duke's power, that is something I'm going to explore. The Newport Restoration Foundation is a $75 million foundation, nonprofit that runs Doris's Rough Point Museum, the home, as a home museum, and also still owns like 75 or so restored colonial houses and rents them out for $5 million a year or so in income. Wow. And they employ probably 100 people and or maybe more with their extended families that people are in the business of like the Doris Duke philanthropic legend, which they want to continue to perpetrate, if you will, perpetuate. And then there's other people in Newport, some on Bellevue Avenue, although a number read my book and were like, right on, brother. You know, they didn't say it that way. Oh, that was quite good. Yes, quite good. Yes. In other words, there are certain elements in the town, and this is what I'm going to get into. Part of what reason I'm doing a follow-up to this is I want to know that. I want to answer that question. It's a great question. How is it that Doris died in 1993 at the age of 80? She had a two-thirds of a page New York Times obituary, even more in the LA Times where she died. And there was one sentence, 34 words devoted to Eduardo Torella's death. Arguably one of the most important events in her life, And there was one word, one sentence devoted to it. Today, now, here's the larger question. The Doris Duke Charitable Foundation is her major foundation based in New York. Guess who? And I'm not impugning him because I love the man. I think he's a hero. Anthony Fauci is like vice chairman of the board of that.
Well, it's also like NPR. You hear it on NPR constantly, brought to you by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation. I'm like, where have I heard this name before? That's where. Holy shit.
And they give out hundreds of thousands of dollars in grants, many to the state of Rhode Island. So people, you know, look, you guys know we're never in the room when the deal is cut, right? We're not flies on the wall. We're never there when that. So all we can do is try and put together the best, reportable version of the truth, as my old friend and mentor Carl Bernstein used to say, But in this case, you just have to consider what's out there. It's, you know how they discovered Pluto, downgraded now from a planet, but they discovered it before they even had a telescope that was precise enough to discover it because of the planetary alignment of other celestial bodies and how it fit in the solar system. Well, that's kind of what investigative reporters do. They try and piece together the truth, the best available version of the truth from all of this stuff. So that's part of what I'm going to be looking at. And one of the biggest disappointments I had in this whole thing is the city manager, Joe Nicholson. Joe Nicholson's father was a lawyer, a wonderful man who represented my father. I trusted Joe throughout this whole thing. He's in charge of the police and fire departments. He, you know, said that he was trying to help me find the missing police report at the time. And I really, you know, during this whole police investigation would text him in the background and he ended up completely dropping the ball on this thing when they just decided to close the case summarily on November 18th. And then after members of the city council were embarrassed about it, he then issued two additional statements. And the final statement he issued is all on my website, peterlance.com. He basically came up with this theory that only a lawyer could come up with. Well, because we could not get into the mind of Doris Duke at the time of the event, we're just going to embrace the accident. Now, I ask you, gentlemen, who cover murder cases all the time, right? Whenever is someone convicted of murder based on what is in the mind of the killer? It never happens. Why? Because of the Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. Almost never do killers take the stand, right? And the only way you can divine what's in their head is if you can cross-examine them in a court of law. And that was never the issue in this case. Because Doris was dead, nobody could be indicted. Nobody could be arrested. So the city of Newport, when they took this on, the police department, when they opened the case, which Nicholson promised me they would see through, and the Jackie Weiss, the detective, said, we will not ignore this. We will find justice for Eduardo. That's her phrase. She asked for my help. We'll get into that later on and then maybe in the next hour. And all of a sudden, it's like the iron gate came down. Boom. You know, and it's all like, okay, we're going to move on now. And I did an event in Newport on the 10th of December, the last big kind of book signing. I went back and like 100 people showed up, and people are like kind of outraged in the town that this is, it's my hometown. I'm ashamed that they would, you know, do this. And there's been international publicity. The Associated Press did two stories when they opened the case and closed it. Over 5,000 media outlets worldwide, from the Washington Post to the Taiwan News, covered this. And that's kind of the record that Newport, Rhode Island wants to stand on.
It doesn't look good. It stinks like Limburger, to be frank with you. But the one thing that really, that you really hit on, and it's something that I think needs to be addressed more, is not just the intransigence of local law enforcement, but on your website, you keep track of the official statements from law enforcement. I believe there are multiple statements, right? There are like three.
Yeah, there are three statements based on the closing after the reopening of the case. But there's also, we can get into, if you want, a series of provable cover-ups by the Newport Restoration Foundation, the guardian of her memory locally, beyond, you know, a nonprofit, by the way, it's $75 million. Their last 990 tax return showed that the top five officers had a combined salary and benefits of $750,000. That's 10% of the net worth of the foundation paid out in executive salary. salaries, and yet they had given away, I think, $11,800 that year, which was 2018, the last year tax forms were available. So the point is, that's a little bit of a scandal in itself. They had never mentioned Eduardo in the 20 years of their existence. It started as a home museum, literally 2020 was the 20th anniversary. And yet, when they got news of my Vanity Fair piece was going to go, it was originally going to go in the summer of 2019, and then they held it for a year, and it was actually better. It was published in July of 2020. But as soon as they got word, at the end of the Rough Point tour, they have like an exhibit space on the second floor that changes every year. Like one year, it's Doris's jewelry, Doris's clothes, you know, that kind of thing. They always change it. Well, they started a wall-sized exhibit called The Accident at Rough Point, okay? And they basically had five affirmative falsehoods, the worst of which is that Doris settled with Torella's family during the wrongful death trial, which is a bold-faced lie, okay? And they said she was unfamiliar with the car, where that three-page transcript, she says, oh yeah, I drove the car twice that day, you know? So the bottom line is the Restoration Foundation itself and hundreds of people visiting that museum in all of 2019, all of 2020, up to March of 2021 had seen that exhibit that was a lie. So I pressed forward and Torella's niece wrote a letter and they finally changed accident to incident in the headline, and they dropped the final paragraph. Now, I haven't been back, nor have I asked anybody if they've gone in since the police did the new cover-up to see if they've restored the word accident at the top of the exhibit, but it's still up there as far as I know. So they continue to, they removed the reliquary of St. Ursula for a whole year, claiming they were cleaning it. The gates of Rough Point were knocked down as a result of an accident in the fall of 2019. And as of last summer, June, they had a little cow fence in front of the estate, you know, on the 20th anniversary of the, you know, you'd think it's the 20th anniversary year, you want to have the beautiful gates up, but the gates are evidence. And just before my book went to press, I asked the guy to go in there and he found the gates covered in a tarp over in the corner of the estate, which I have, you know, pictured in the book. The point is, it's very ham-handed, but effective. You know, cover up has many, many dimensions, and there's a physical cover up and there's a legal cover up going on right now to this day in Newport, Rhode Island. And I'm hoping the hope I have with this podcast of yours, a celebrated podcast, is that maybe some people will, you know, just get interested and want to see the truth come out.
So we've gone in a roughly linear fashion up to this point, and you'll notice, fellow astute listeners, that we are discussing this as an ongoing thing, something that originally occurred in 1966. But what revelations led us to discuss this in the present day? What led an award-winning journalist? We can see, by the way, Peter, for people watching this on YouTube, we can see your Emmys in the background, sir. So what led an award-winning journalist to not just write an 8,000-word piece for Vanity Fair, but what led you to write an entire book on this? I think it's also important to clarify, just for perspective, earlier, Peter, when you were referring to November, you were talking about November of this year, just last month. That is how fresh these developments are. So could you say that there was something you found that was new to the case, that was something no one else had heard of?
Well, thank you. First of all, one of the most gratifying things to me that happened was after the Vanity Fair piece that hit on the 16th of July of 2020, and the next day I commenced writing the book, you know, 12-hour days for 6 months, and the book was published in February in four editions, by the way, hardcover, paperback, Kindle, ebook, and Audible. And if you can believe listening to me for 10 hours, I did the narration. Drove me to do the book was partly that COVID, you know, I was sequestered and I had the time, and there was so much material that I just couldn't get to in the Vanity Fair piece. So I published the book, and what happened was last summer I had a wonderful opportunity with the Brenton Hotel, this beautiful new hotel on Newport's waterfront that had me come in as what they called author in residence for a month. And they would put copies of my books in all their Tony rooms. You know, they have 50 some rooms they put copies in. And then a couple of nights a week, I would come to their beautiful cocktail lounge called the living room. And I would, you know, discuss the book, and people would come down from their rooms, and then Newporters who had bought the book and wanted it signed would show up. So on a rainy afternoon, on July 3rd, I was doing that, you know, and all of a sudden this heavy set guy with a walrus mustache, it was kind of looking at me ominously. My cousin Sheila Tyler, who's like my right arm, and you know, she's at all the events and helps me. She's like pointing to him, like I was talking to some doctors from Philadelphia who was staying, and she kept going like, "You got to talk to this guy. This guy's got some information." I said, "Okay, you know." So finally, Bob came up to me and he handed me this email, and it said, he said, "Why didn't you get back to me?" And I'm like, "What?" And I looked at it, and it was dated the day I started writing the book. And he had written to me saying I was the paper boy at Rough Point. And I responded immediately, "I'll get back to you." But I never did, partly because I was writing the book, and also because there was another paper boy that I found that was not really the paper boy for Rough Point, but he covered Bellevue Avenue and was on his way there that night. And I interviewed him, and I just kind of, you know, put the two together in my head. So anyway, after I apologized to Bob, I took him to the bar. He's been sober for more than 30 years, and he held me spellbound, okay, for 3 hours. When you're in this kind of business, as you guys know, you'll always get the pretender, the poser. I knew the second gunman on the grassy knoll. You know, guys in prison constantly write to me. And so you have to develop a sixth sense for, a shit detector, if you will. Since we're on a podcast, I'll use that legal term of art. You know, I have a law degree from Fordham, but, you know, the shit detector. And so Bob was so amazing because I had him tell the story to me 5 times. And every single time he was absolutely dead on precise. So the next day I took him up to Rough Point myself, and I, with my iPhone, I basically shot him from 5 different angles. He had been, well, we'll get to that in the next hour, but you know, the details of what he learned and what I learned. But as a result of Bob, he had read my book just like 6 weeks earlier. And what I put in the book about Fred Newton's up on the hood theory of the crash dovetailed precisely with his memory of events that night. And that he went to the police department the day before he went to me, and they reopened the case. And that became the major international news. The Associated Press covered it. I did a second Vanity Fair piece on August 5th. And then everything just blew up. And stay tuned.
And that's what led our listener to write in and turn us on to your work in the first place. They were referring to that second Vanity Fair piece.
Exactly. So the first one, you can look it up right now on Vanity Fair if you're by your computer. Homicide at Rough Point, written by Peter Lance. That's July 16th, 2020. That's the original one. Second piece is titled "The Doris Duke Cold Case Reopens, The Only Known Eyewitness Speaks for the First Time." Again, August 5th, Peter Lance in Vanity Fair.
I'm sorry for jumping in, but they're both on peterlance.com. It's PETERLANCE.com. So if you go there, you can get all the pieces, all the international coverage, and then all this latest development on what happened.
And stay tuned for our next part in this series where, Peter, you're hopefully, you've agreed off air to join us for the second part. So, everyone stay tuned. We're also going to talk a little bit about some of your other work in the next hour. So, what a ride. What a ride, Matt Knoll. This is why we made this a two-parter, right?
Absolutely. We've covered a ton of ground. We have much more to get into. So for now, we're going to stop. If you want to contact us, you know how to do it. We're on Twitter and Facebook and YouTube at Conspiracy Stuff, on Instagram at Conspiracy Stuff Show. You can call our phone number.
You can indeed. Just dial 1-833-STDWYTK. You'll get a message letting you know you're in the right place. You'll have 3 minutes. Those 3 minutes are your own. Tell us what's on your mind. Tell us about more regional cases of crimes by the wealthy. And perhaps most importantly, let us know if we can use your name and or voice on air. Even more importantly than most importantly, Don't censor yourself. If you have something that needs more than 3 minutes, then write it all out. Give us the links. Give us the photos. We are sponges for this sort of stuff. We can't wait to hear from you. We read every email we get. All you have to do is drop us a line where we are.
Conspiracy@iHeartRadio.com. Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.